Hello and welcome to the Hardy Report. My name's Edward Hardy, and for today's interview, I'm joined by Paul Mason, the former business editor of Newsnight, the former economics editor of Channel 4, and the author of multiple books, including Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future, and most recently, How to Stop Fascism, History, Ideology, Resistance, both of which are available to purchase now. Paul Mason, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure.
The UK is in the midst of a cost of living crisis. We're in a turbulent time for the economy as a whole, and many reasons have been cited for this, from Brexit to the war in Ukraine to the policies of the Conservative Party. What do you see as the root cause of the economic situation we're witnessing unfold?
Well, I've always described myself as a political economist. I'm not a professional economist, but I can tell you this, that now is the time that the discipline of political economy is really going to be needed. Because everything you mentioned, you know, Brexit, a self-inflicted wound, the war in Ukraine, which without doubt is driving a large part of the energy and food price increases. And then we've got deglobalization, another political event. As we came out of the COVID crisis, major states, major economies decided they suddenly needed supply chains for stuff they'd always been happy to buy on the open market. And so every big economy moved from securing supplies of PPE equipment, which they didn't want to get stranded on the runway, as they famously did in Turkey, to securing supplies of semiconductors, oil, gas, coal. And so these three things, the breakup of the world economy, Putin using energy as a weapon of war against Western democracies, and Brexit, I'm afraid, have put us in the perfect, not even the perfect storm. If you don't mind my saying so, the perfect pile of shit, basically. We are really in it. We are facing the worst. You know, even if we only hit inflation at 14%, we'll be facing the worst in the developed world. The recent professional economist prediction of 22% would be, you know, it would turn the British economy into a quasi developing world economy temporarily, in the way how it felt. Ultimately, though, all of these political acts perpetrated against us in the case of Putin, perpetrated on ourselves in the case of Brexit, all these acts are a product of having an economy and an economic model that doesn't fundamentally work. I've been saying since 2008, since I got off the plane from New York, having covered the Lehman Brothers crisis, the way we ran our economy for 20 years before that just blew up in our faces. And we never faced that. We never decided we need to create a different kind of economy. We tried to turn over the economy we had, make it work with a lot of printed money and a lot of borrowing. That's the root cause.
You talk about the difference between economists, political economists, whether it's economic solutions or political solutions. What do you think needs to happen here now? Is the issue that we need greater economic solutions being put in place? We need to turn to the experts to provide financial solutions? Or is it the political solutions have to be dealt with before you can even think about the economic situation?
There's something I'd say before that. For about 20 years, at the height of what we call neoliberalism, when everybody thought capitalism was perfect, people like me, who think it's highly imperfect, were in a minority. And I can remember my Oxbridge-educated colleagues at Newsnight saying to me, effectively, all capitalism's problems have been solved. And the underlying assumption behind that technocratic politics was that there is a solution in real time to everything. If something goes wrong, the Bank of England or the Treasury, or maybe, you know, we can have a commission to sort it out, some clever people will come up with the answer. What we're finding now is that's not true, that you can end up in situations, as our grandparents did and our great-grandparents, where the time to solve it was 20 years ago. We're now 14 years on from the Lehman Brothers crisis. The time to avoid Britain becoming a stagnant economy, which isn't growing, but has double-digit inflation, was 2008, 2009. That's the problem. And so when you ask me what are the solutions, I'd say it's not going to be of any use to somebody queuing to buy their kids' fish fingers off the sell-by date shelf right now. But the long-term solution, and there is one, is to rapidly decarbonize our economy, borrow the money to invest to do that, and we will end up building our economy almost from scratch and renewed, using the skills we have, using new skills we learn along the way, educating and training a whole bunch of people from GPs to practice nurses to engineers to shipbuilders. That's the way to do it. That's no use to somebody who's starving or can't switch their central heating on right now or knows they can't in October. So in the medium term, we're going to need a government that is prepared to change things radically. I don't know, the jury's out for me whether Labour really wants to do that. I think the radical moment for Britain would come if we ended up with a coalition government of the SNP, Plaid Cymru, Labour, the Greens, maybe the Lib Dems if they're prepared to do it, which says we change the constitution so that the progressive majority in this country can be the majority in Parliament. And we, you know, big institutional reforms, big devolution of power, but the end result will be the implementation of that. It's often called the Green New Deal. Call it what you want, big green investment program, not just in wind turbines and solar panels, but in education, in skills, in big cities like where I live, London, you know, 20-minute communities where everything is within walking distance, in the renewal and the reindustrialization of our ex-industrial towns. That's what I think you could do that in 5 years, right? 5 to 10 years. Right now, the solution is to kick the government out because they will do none of that. I mean, at least if Sunak has lost or loses the Tory leadership campaign, contest, then at least, see, Sunak's philosophy was that your generation and your children should not pay the costs of climate change, that we should. In other words, anything that greens the economy should be paid for by taxation alone, not borrowing or money printing, and therefore you can only do so much of it. In a way, Sunak's austerian mindset was strangling the post-COVID recovery. It was also strangling the green transition we need to make. If Truss is prepared to say, okay, we'll borrow we're going to stage the paying back of the COVID borrowing so we don't bankrupt ourselves, then I would say that opens up a very interesting policy opportunity for the left to say, right, on the same token, we need to borrow to do the green transition. If we can begin to do that, I think we can open up a lot of opportunities for the people who need them. If you're on the minimum wage, what do you need? A better job. Where's those better jobs going to come from by creating the kind of economy that isn't full of crap jobs? And how you do that is you have to have an industrial policy and you have to have partnership with trade unions. And instead of looking at something like the RMT union and saying, how can we get rid of that? How can we get rid of guards on trains? You think, how can we put guards on trains? There's plenty of people serving you tea, coffee and biscuits. They don't seem to be worried about having lots of people on very low wages serving you tea, coffee and biscuits. But how about a guard? How about, you know, some more jobs at train stations to help people? So, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I would advocate. And I would think that I think generationally Britain is turning towards those kinds of solutions. I hope. And I think the winter we're about to live through really will teach us there is no alternative to a radical change.
The idea of a radical change is one that people are starting to come on board with and starting to see. But a lot of the issues we're recognising with the current energy policies that exist are partly due to short-term thinking that has existed within politics, in governments, both Labour, Conservative, the coalition governments. There was a clip that surfaced of Nick Clegg basically rejecting the concept of even thinking about investing in nuclear power because that would have taken 10 years. That was back in 2010.
10 years
if
ago,
they
yeah.
Invested right now, we wouldn't necessarily be facing the problems we're having. Do you see that the problem then exists partly in politics, where people are driven in our political system to focus on the short term. There's very little long-term thinking, and that can be applied to the health service, to education policy, to energy policy. These are big topics that can't just be dealt with in changes every few years. They have to have a long-term strategy.
Let's not let the real culprit off the hook. Where does short-termism come from, philosophically? Because when I grew up, short-termism wasn't really a thing. You know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s when you had, you know, Labour government sat down and said, we need a supersonic airliner. Sort of five guys sitting around a table with like sort of paper notepads took minutes and said, okay, we'll commission one at this meeting, Concorde. Get on with it, build a prototype in 2 years. I mean, that was long-term thinking. Short-termism came in the moment we decided to turn all politics into economics. That is, that all politics can be decided through market forces, market norms of behavior. And, you know, if you, it's not even short-termism, it's nowism, in the sense that you'd simply say, well, I see it all around me in this energy crisis, people saying, okay, what's the market solution to the energy crisis? Let's create two markets, one market for renewables, another market for oil and gas. Let the two prices float at different levels, and that'll sort it out. No, it won't, because this is not a market issue. It's a issue of Putin using energy economics to attack our democracy, and it's an issue of climate change. And the two are linked, because I think the root of why Putin is prepared to be so nihilistic, so desperate, is because he knows within 20 or 30 years, the hold he has over Europe through oil and gas will be over, because we'll have done the green transition. This is the last gasp of what we call a rentier oligarchy. You know, they don't work, they don't innovate, they don't really invest. All they do is mine oil and gas out of the earth. And there's a limit to what to that that's going to happen. So, okay, short-term thinking then throughout the neoliberal era were characterized most economic policymaking. But in the times it didn't, you'd have to say, I'll give you an example. It's long forgotten now, but one of the first stories I worked on in Newsnight was the Wanless Report. Now, this was Gordon Brown saying, we need to raise British healthcare from about 5 to 6% of GDP to something like 8 or 9%. And to do that, we're gonna have to tax people more. And this guy, Derek Wanless, big, huge report, as thick as a kind of Bible, came out and it said, right, we can do this the hard way or the easy way. And the easy way is to do everything through technology. So we're going to totally digitize the NHS, totally bring in e-consulting. We'll bring in clinics that do everything. Your records will be there. It doesn't matter whether you see the same doctor. All that was the Gordon Brown revolution in healthcare. What happened? The technology didn't work. It still doesn't work. I personally was part of a fight last year to prevent a huge data scrape of patient records, because I don't want my records going to the private sector, thank you very much, under some private capitalist deal done with the NHS. And so even when governments think long-term, the market and private ownership always gets in the way of the long-term execution. And I think that this energy crisis we're living through, it's not just Nick Clegg blocking nuclear. The ultimate problem is no one could imagine a world in which the American president was a sort of Mussolini-style figure. You know, I wouldn't say he's fascist Trump yet, but he's on a journey in that direction, prepared to collaborate with a far-right ethno-nationalist murderer in the Kremlin to destroy NATO, to destroy the European Union, to destroy the global, the rules-based global order. Remember, in 2018, Trump threatened to leave NATO and refused to sign a declaration supporting the rules-based global order. So if you can't imagine that, then fine, you know, give away your nuclear, you know, shut down your coal-fired power stations for perfectly good reasons, run down your gas storage, do all these things, Fine. But where are we now? We're not the only country that's done that. Germany has tied itself to Russia's fate through the gas diplomacy of Angela Merkel. No, I don't think, I mean, I've been very doomy. I'm a doom, you know, doom monger in many ways about capitalism. I think it's destroying the earth, and I think it's going to destroy itself, and it's destroying democracy. But even I didn't think Putin would invade Ukraine. I was in Ukraine 36 hours before he invaded, partly because I thought, well, you know, I'll take a chance and go and ignore the Foreign Office advice. And the Foreign Office advice got more and more frantic as we were there. But even as I flew out, I'm scurried to the airport with a brick-sized wad of Ukrainian money to get on the first plane I could get on. I thought, why would he do it? This is crazy. This is going to destroy his relationship with the rest of the world. Well, it turns out for Putin, politics is more important than economics. And a lot of people in politics and administration and civil service and, you know, venerable professors in Oxbridge departments don't understand that. They're still living in a world where they think politics is basically economics. And I think it isn't. And the way out of this is through political struggle, struggle against the far right, struggle against authoritarian and racist forms of conservatism. And of course, you know, my latest fight, struggle against forms of leftism that are way, way too cozy and pally with totalitarian dictatorships.
If the polls are to be believed, Liz Truss will be the next prime minister. Economic experts have claimed that her proposed policies will worsen the current crisis, cause inflation to soar higher. Alongside that, the other issue that you mentioned, there is a fear of creeping authoritarianism that among the current conservative governments. That was happening under Boris Johnson. We saw that with, for example, the laws against protest. What is your biggest fear, would you say, with the incoming administration?
With Liz Truss, I think the biggest fear I have is not about she rips up the Treasury rules. I think it would do the Treasury good to have some political control. And I certainly, when I was allied to Corbyn and John McDonnell, wanted there to be a big change in the Treasury's culture, its rules, and indeed the Bank of England's remit. There's nothing wrong with saying, a 20 to 30 year old regime of economic management no longer applies in a world of double digit inflation and stagnation. Rip it up and take political control of economic policymaking. You're going to have to do that as a Labour government anyway. So I'm not so worried about that. Yes, I think the tax cuts will be, what the tax cuts are the new version of levelling up. Levelling up never happened, okay? It was a bunch of 1 billion, sort of a billion here, a billion there, to towns the Tories thought they could keep in the next election. That's not levelling up. That's not making Wigan, where I come from, a place that young people think, hey, I want to invest in here, I want to stay here, let's buy a house, let's build a career. It's still... Large parts of the north of England are still places that young people with an education and training will just get out of because there's not enough there, not enough jobs, not enough growth, not enough culture and opportunity. So I think that's cancelled under Truss. She hasn't expressed any interest in it whatsoever. And so tax cuts are the replacement, and tax cuts are aimed at Tunbridge Wells. They're aimed at Devon and, you know, sort of Somerset, to try and hold that core Tory vote. Now, I'm actually not that worried that stimulates inflation. The inflation is largely externally driven. There'll be some more inflation. But what I would like to see as well is the Bank of England push back against the recession. I'd like as well to see a government take control of prices through price caps and price freezes, not just on energy, which we've got, which is what Labour's proposing, but on rent, on transport costs, on education costs. Instead, my biggest fear actually is that Truss's administration will be a fiasco, because the Tory party is now split down the middle between the austerity mongers, the kind of nostalgics for the era of tight money and austerity. That was what Sunak stood on. And the kind of populists who will spend any money to stay in power. And Johnson, in a way, held that all together. Johnson was a social liberal. I mean, he left it to Priti Patel to threaten to sink migrants in, you know, implicitly threaten to sort of, you know, rock the migrants' boats a bit, see if anybody fell off. That never happened because the Royal Navy wouldn't do it. I'll tell you one thing as well. This anti-protest law, terrible though it is, I think will be proven this winter not to be worth the paper it's written on. Because it's one thing when you've got the miners' strike and the police going in, you know, in 1984, 85, to stop that, a kind of them and us situation. The police who would be deployed to stop protests this winter will see their pay cut and they'll see their families not being able to turn off on and off the central heating. And if you're thinking about sending the army in, it's the same for them, only worse because of defence cuts. I think Truss is going to face a major period of political and social instability. And from what I can, I mean, let's not denigrate her. She is a, you know, maths degree, professional mathematician. She is clever, but you can be clever at politics. You can be clever at maths and crap at politics. And my observation is, unlike Johnson, she's pretty crap at politics. And I don't think she can hold together the Tory party unless something massive happens, like a war or a major kind of outage of energy, you know, the kind of outage of energy that sees, as I saw when I was 13 years old, a minister come on telly with a candle saying, "We're really sorry, the lights have gone off." Maybe the Tory party will rally at that point, but I don't see it. Anything less than that, I don't see it.
You talked there about the austerity wing of the Conservative Party, and when the Conservative Party is often criticised over its fiscal policies, people talk about the austerity measures that they brought into place, cutting spending, failing to provide proper funding for necessary services. However, looking at trends of public spending since 1997-98, on the government's website shows that total managed expenditure has continued to rise. There wasn't at any point during that period an actual fall in government spending. Is it less about the amount that's being spent then and about the allocation? And if so, what do you see as the necessary reallocation of that spending?
Well, let's remember, the austerity years were Cameron Osborne and Clegg. And you know, the health service, policing, defence were all cut at the start of the 2010 decade. Now, I argued at the time that that was self-defeating, that it would tank the economy, and therefore you would need more cuts. And that's what George Osborne did. He cut, thinking, you know, they had this theory that if you cut spending, growth would come from somewhere else. It didn't happen. And we on the left were not surprised. But the damage that did is still with us. If you think about it, you know, I saw a headline in the Times today, as if somebody else was, you know, terror, isn't this terrible? They said, burglary and fraud or something like that are effectively decriminalized. Well, that's right. You know, 4% in rape cases of I think 4% conviction rate in rape cases. Get your house burgled, as I did. Someone actually climbed through my window, stole my cameras. The police came around. I was absolutely surprised. You know, that was great. But nothing happened. Why? Because there aren't enough police. There aren't even enough police to police organized crime. And so that's the legacy. And it erodes. What does it do? Is it erodes society. If you're waiting 18 months, you know, for a cancer operation, if you're waiting 12 hours at an A&E, if your streets, as in parts of Liverpool and many other cities, are full of organized criminals, of the low, you know, low level organized criminals, guys on little scooters and e-bikes, and the police can't do anything about them. You think, after a while, you think, hold on a minute, what am I actually getting out of fulfilling my social obligations? I think that was the erosion, the social corrosion that austerity achieved. And of course, Johnson eventually came in and said, oh, you know, can't go on doing this. And then COVID came along. You know, I was part of the team that helped design Labour's 2019 fiscal offer. I had nothing to do with the manifesto, but we discussed the fiscal offer. And, you know, I think I can remember saying, you know, £250 million. So £250 billion borrowed over a period of 5 years to do the Green New Deal is a lot of money, but it's justified. We can sell it to the population. We couldn't. We didn't. Sunak borrowed £330 billion in a single year to do COVID. And so we now have to think in chunks of a third of a trillion for every crisis. A third of a trillion was needed to sort out COVID. I think this energy crisis could probably be sorted out. Some economists were writing to the FT today, including Danny Blanchflower, ex-Bank of England, basically saying £120 billion. So, you know, that's a sixth of a billion, of a trillion rather. £120 billion could probably pay our way through nationalizing some energy firms, subsidizing some prices, taking control of the energy market, price freezing, security of supply, new nuclear. We have to think in sums that big. So here's the problem. The population doesn't think like that. The population is still enraptured with this, what we call the household finance analogy. The idea that the government's finances have to be run like a household. It has to balance the books at the end of a month or year. And that's entirely erroneous. It would be entirely wrong, even if we were in a kind of quite stable capitalism where the only problem was, how do you build an Olympic stadium? We're in a problem where, how do you rearm the country? The army, the navy, the air force, the cyber force, the space force, because a country, Russia, is severely aggressing against us and our allies. So we have to rearm. We need to arm ourselves energy-wise to be secure. So we need new nuclear, rapid solar, rapid wind, wave, hydrogen, everything, storage. How do you do that? Money. And I just think that's my plea to the people who listen to this is, we've got to move where from a situation where people who say that are kind of put on the extremes and say, you know, we might have Paul Mason on Newsnight once a year just to remind people how nutty these extremes are, to the center. And I think I'm hopeful that that can happen. I want there to be a conservative equivalent of the kind of radical rebuilding, reconstruction, rearmament, regeneration of hope project that I espouse, because unless we make it a bipartisan thing with all parts of society buying into it, it's not going to have its ultimate benefit, which is to protect us against the divisions and weakness that people like Putin and his allies are trying to sow within our society.
You talked earlier about your thoughts on the current situation within the Labour Party, and I know that you recently said that you support Keir Starmer, and you also supported Jeremy Corbyn during his time. And I'd be interested in your view on, during Jeremy Corbyn's time, his supporters would often argue that Labour's failure to secure a parliamentary majority was due to people attacking him from within the Labour Party. Now Keir Starmer is in post, we're seeing his supporters argue that Labour will struggle to secure a majority if those on other elements of the left continue to attack him rather than focusing their ire on the Conservative Party. As you mentioned, the first step to addressing the challenges people have in this country, in your view, is removing this current government from power. The way to do that is by electing a Labour government or a progressive alliance on the left, which would be led in this current situation by Keir Starmer. Do you think that Labour's infighting is what's preventing it from holding office and defeating the Tories here? And if so, how does that get stopped? Because it seems that whichever faction is in control at one side, the other side is fighting it.
I think, sadly, Labour is always a factional party. You know, it's born of a movement, the Labour movement, that has historically had two conflicting goals: to manage capitalism and to supersede capitalism with something better. Now, there are very few outright anti-capitalists who would think about superseding capitalism in their lifetime within Labour, but those differences remain. You can see it over the question of picket lines. Do we go on them? Do we stay away from them? You can see it over the extreme enmity that a lot of, you know, my friends in the Corbyn movement, some of them just can't move on. They can't move on from the fact that they believe, you know, people that, leave aside Keir Starmer, some of them believe I personally, you know, I'm responsible for the failure of the Corbyn project, because I wouldn't sit there silently as a ridiculous position developed of not having a position on Brexit. Just fought really hard within Corbynism to say, look, either vote to let Theresa May's deal go through, or a version of it, or fight it. And they just couldn't, because this concatenation of forces would never decide. The only thing I can say to people trying to understand where we are is, it's not about Keir Starmer and it wasn't about Corbyn. It's about British neoliberal free market capitalism has a very specific crisis. That is, we are the country that was the guinea pig for smashing the working class, smashing communities, smashing trade unions, and replacing them with an extreme form of individualism where everybody renegotiates their own pay rise behind the backs of their colleagues at work and the rest of it. Okay, we other countries like Germany, even now, Germany, as it goes into this extreme winter of energy crisis, is having meetings where the prime minister meets the trade unions and they agree on a program. It's not like the prime minister tells them what the program is. There is partnership. France has, to an extent, partnership with organized labor. We threw organized labor out the window. I revere the democracy that we have built in this country, but I always remind people, without the labor movement, it wouldn't exist. If you watch Poldark, you'll realize that neither the bourgeoisie nor the aristocracy, you know, War Leggan or Ross Poldark himself, the nascent bourgeois, they don't want democracy. They don't want people to vote. It's the workers who imposed democracy on people like that over the 19th century. And we're now facing the first time in our history where there's an atomized labor movement which doesn't have strength. Now, labor's troubles are only, in a way, a reflection of that. A reflection of the crisis of direction of thinking about a new political economic model. Why did some hardliners in Labour really distrust Corbyn? Because he was going to renationalise the Bank of England, because he was renationalising rail, renationalising energy, all the things we should be doing now. I supported Starmer because I thought he could hold the party together. I'm not sure in the long run that's possible. I wrote at the last conference, it felt like two parties, but it has been two or three parties for most of its history. And what you need is a common project that can hold people together. I think what Starmer proposes in terms of, and Rachel Reeves, in terms of Green New Deal, 28 billion a year, borrowed and spent on the future of our energies and economy and transport, is the bedrock of what we can all agree on. I think radical devolution, constitutional reform, will be another thing that can bring us together. The missing bit is supporting people when they fight back. And the left are absolutely correct here. The people who've enough is enough, or the don't pay campaign, you know, I'm going to be part of both those things because I want us to be a party that supports people when they fight back. And I think I want to persuade my friends in the Labour front bench that they lose nothing by being among those who fight back. And in fact, they will gain, especially in this winter of discontent that's coming, because we're going to see discontent among people you don't normally see it among. I've heard that, you know, the Don't Pay campaign is signing up people in pubs, going up to them, people, activists, they go up and say, I'm not going to pay my bills on 1st of October. What about you? And often they'll say back to them, I'm already not paying it. You know, it's just because I can't, you know, screw it. That feels to me like a poll tax moment. And, you know, Labour front bench better get on board with that. I don't know if your listeners know, but I'm trying to become a Labour MP. I have tried, will carry on trying. And I'll be absolutely clear. One of the reasons I want to do that is because I want there to be a left that is realistic about what you can achieve, but never deserts working class people when they're in struggle, and never also weakens on the defense of democracy against the kind of attacks that are coming at us from Trumpism, from Putinism, from the far right, from China. So we've got to have a new kind of left that is effective, that stands in the front ranks of people who are struggling, but knows how to channel that energy into an economic program that can change things and solve things rapidly, rather than a kind of wish list up here in the stratosphere that's never going to happen.
Since you might very well be in Parliament in the not too distant future, and you might have,
but go on.
Well, you might have an influence on policies, and you already have within the Labour Party in the past. If you could enact one policy right now to tackle the challenges that you see facing the UK, what would it be and why?
I would immediately ask the government to take a golden share in the UK assets of all the oil and gas majors. So these are companies like BP, Shell, Apache, that dig the gas and the oil out of the North Sea. You wouldn't need to nationalize them, because you couldn't afford to nationalize them legally. We'd be talking hundreds of billions. But you could take a golden share, as exists with certain defense companies, where you put a minister on the board, and the minister then says, for 18 months, we're going to cut the price of oil and gas, the wholesale price that is then sold to the transmission firms and to the retailers. You would still have to pay the global price of wholesale energy, which is huge. But for those producing in the North Sea, it's not costing them any more to produce than it was, or much more to produce than it was last year. So why should they be making 170 billion extra profits simply out of a change in a global price that doesn't really affect supply and demand here? So there's another way of doing this, which would be to say, we take all of that 170 billion as tax and give it to consumers, and they spend it on the massively increased energy. And where does it end up? It ends up back in the pockets of the oil majors. I would prefer to cut out the middle people and actually just do a wartime measure. It's what we would do in wartime, but unfortunately, Vladimir Putin is waging an energy war on our democracy. We need to realize that. In wartime, the state takes control of strategic assets and of the price of everything it can take control of. That's what we need to do. I don't say do it forever. I don't say nationalize them full stop. I simply say to keep the lights on. You don't tinker with the retail companies. You don't tinker with handouts to people. You just have to price fix for a bit and then get back to normal when Putin's gone. We haven't talked about my book, but it is now out in paperback, and it's only £9 or something. So if you hate fascism and want to know how to fight it, please buy it.
Paul Mason, thank you for joining me.
Cheers. Great. I enjoyed it. Great.
That was Paul Mason, the former business editor of Newsnight and former economics editor of Channel 4. He's the author of multiple books, including Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future, and How to Stop Fascism, History, Ideology, Resistance, both of which are available to purchase now. You can find out more about him on Twitter at Paul Mason News and at paulmason.org. That's all for today's episode. What did you think about that interview? Let me know on Twitter at Edward T. Hardy. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Recommend this podcast by submitting a review online and sharing it with friends and family. Until next time, goodbye.